I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Bill T. Jones is one of the country's most celebrated dancers and choreographers who has received many prestigious awards and honors. His career has spanned more than 40 years. He comes from a large family that moved north to New York State to find a better life. He discovered dance in college, where he also met his partner, Arnie Zane. They performed together until Zane died of AIDS in the 1980s. Jones has been dancing until almost 10 years ago. He continues to work as a choreographer, collaborating with diverse artists, and as a director. He's been intrigued by the music and ideas of composer John Cage, which is the basis for his dance piece, Storytime. He has translated that performance into a book also called Storytime, subtitled The Life of an Idea. Jones weaves stories from his family and his career with thoughts about the role of the artist and his conflicted thoughts and feelings about John Cage. And we're thrilled that Bill T. Jones joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. So nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
You begin your book, actually the preface to your book, with this sentence: "The object you were holding in your hands is conflicted." The object being, of course, this book. Conflicted
yes.
for you, conflicted for us, conflicted how?
Definitely conflicted for me. First of all, it's a book that was supposed to have been a record of three lectures. And lectures, as you know, are different than actually reading literature. And the lectures themselves were a rumination on a performance, that were a rumination on the work of another artist who did this work in 1958. So there's lots of levels of conflict and questioning, which I think is the hallmark of what the artistic discourse is.
You first met John Cage, I guess you were at in college. This was back in the early 70s?
Well, I couldn't say I met him, but I was in the audience in the student commons room, which was already odd, considering that these things would have been happening in a theater or in a music venue. But no, he was in this common room with couches, and I think all of the instruments were laid out and people were sitting around, very much of that period. I'm so glad it was such a relaxed first introduction to this music.
Why so?
Well, it was tough going. It was not designed to seduce the ear. It was I couldn't quite understand what the ideas were. What was the point of these squeaks and squawks? And I understood only later that there was something to take away that was about thinking about what had happened to you and changing your expectations. And I think that's what made him a great artist.
You even write about being bored during it.
Yes, I knew you were trying to get that line.
I was working towards that, right? You were bored.
Yes, you know, he's often labeled with that. I understood that night that boredom in and of itself is not a problem, because for the week after, I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
So I say art making is participation in the world of ideas, and I believe that that's when I first saw evidence of that in that performance.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your book, and this is about John Cage.
Every year, from approximately the middle of December to the last week of January, Bjorn and I spend time on the mesa of northern New Mexico. It's quiet and open there, with mountains all around. The sky shifts constantly, as does the wind and light. Still, one has the impression that nothing changes. In fact, it feels like the sort of place one might create in the future, when we can custom make a virtual vacation spot. One afternoon, halfway through my holiday, I was determined to listen to John Cage read Indeterminacy Part 2 for inspiration and as a means of getting away from the list of things, people, and feelings inside of me. In the mesa light and quiet, I was writing this story as I was listening to his recording, attempting to name the very things I was trying to forget.
And this is this indeterminacy.
Yes, this is it. I mean, I did not do... The stories are written in the style of John Cage, who thought of them not as literature, but as composition. So every word is plotted out to the second.
Yeah.
And if you see the book, or if you see John Cage's classic Indeterminacy, it looks like a strange music score with 6 lines of 10 seconds each. And it makes for really hairy going when the stories are very long, and it makes it very uncomfortable when the stories don't have many words, because there are these peculiar stops and starts, which he loved. And then there's the element of music as well, which gets inject it, and I'd say crashes into the narratives.
But I get the feeling you have struggled with this, with John Cage, his music, his ideas, what he was trying or is trying to do.
Well, I don't know how you feel about this life, but I find that oftentimes I want to take an external focus for something that is ultimately internal. Why do I feel alienated? Why do I feel I never had an intellectual home? And I say it's because of aloof modernists like John Cage. I say aloof. I was not in his circle.
Right.
But also our descriptions are so different that I felt that when I look at this kind of plain-faced and very leveling approach he had to subject matter, I think, well, what does it mean for me to take that stance? Am I allowed? He was a white male, and they can claim neutrality. I can't claim neutrality. I don't feel neutral in this culture. So, but can I take on the mantle and see what happens and not be sarcastic about it? Really accept his rules with my hot temperament. And that's what makes the work exciting, and I think that's what makes it a gift of his to me.
Is he, I mean, clearly he's someone who has influenced you or perhaps haunted you. I don't know if
both,
whether that's the right word or not. But clearly you've been grappling with him for some time now.
Yes. Well, what does it mean to be pure, to be undistracted by commerce, to be bravely misunderstood? These were the hallmarks of modernism. I was told that the serious artists are never understood in their time. And I'm thinking, is that true? You add to that the element of race and class and all of that, and what it would take to have more people like my mother, like my nieces and nephews come to the performance. And I think, well, could I make work like that with my values, many of which were gleaned from modernists like John Cage? Mm-hmm. That's a question mark. You know, we shall see.
You, another section, which I'll just read a couple of sentences here. You write, later over dinner, Stephen Wright, a manager for a symphony orchestra, said of both Cage and Schoenberg, for practically 70 years, conductors and impresarios have been trying to force this stuff on audiences. When will they realize people just don't get it? Audiences just don't want it. It doesn't work.
Isn't that an outrageous line?
It is an outrageous line.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a very sophisticated music man, high-level symphony orchestras who have this immovable bias that, you know, that we can, in other words, history has stopped. We know now what people like, and this is what's worth doing. And yet there are those cantankerous likes, those cantankerous persons like John Cage, and I see many of them in my theater in New York, New York Live Arts, young folks who are going to attack the barricades again and again, and they're going to sometimes reinvent the wheel, and they are extremely alienated, and they're oftentimes rather effete and rather arrogant. But we love them for that, because they keep the ball moving. No, it is, the verdict is not out on what is worth doing, Mr. Wright.
Yeah. That's your argument back to him.
Oh, yes. I mean, my whole life has been that.
Right.
Oh, no, I don't believe it ever stops. It's like my friend, my companion, my husband, Bjorn, has his image. He said, think of it like the horizon. Can you ever truly get to the horizon? Mm. That's what artistic pursuit is.
You, as I understand it, it wasn't until you got to college that you discovered dance. Is that right? Mm-hmm. You were, I guess, a theater major when you started out.
I guess if you want to call it that, I was lucky to be born during the Camelot, not born, no, spiritually born, perhaps. I was born in 52, but it was the Camelot era when there was money around for these sort of social uplifting projects. And we had a drama teacher, speech teacher, Miss Mary Lee Shapey, and I will always think of her as a great savior of my soul, so to speak, who said, you always want to show off. Why don't you get some skill and learn something?
This was in high school?
Oh, yeah, and in grade school even. You know, she was, and she really encouraged it. And she knew what I was going through in that German-Italian community. She asked me one day, I think we'd just seen on the evening news something that came from a church in Alabama with Martin Luther King speaking. And she said, what did you think of that? All that shouting and amen and all. And I knew it. I lived in a house with a mother who did just that. But I didn't think that white people were paying attention. But then she was paying attention. And she was actually talking to me as a young thinking person. And in a way, she was asking me, I believe she was speaking to me as a black person, which people didn't really do unless it was some way a bit patronizing. That was a great learning experience. She was my drama teacher, and she was the one during those turbulent 60s from that vantage point of a small agrarian community in upstate New York, was able to keep it personal and at the same time say constantly through her actions as well as her words, there's a big world here, Bill.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Are you going to participate? Yeah. I loved that about her.
Well, and it's, I mean, how wonderful to have a teacher, especially at a young age, who sort of saw you, perhaps.
Don't we all need it?
Indeed.
We really
indeed
do.
Indeed, we do.
Yeah. Sometimes when I look at young relatives and all who have fallen back into food stamps or fallen into drug use or living in these kind of communities, what we call them ghettos, I'm thinking, hey, wait a minute. We were supposed to have escaped this now. What happened? You can either get angry, you can get depressed, you can yourself turn to drugs or excess, or you can think deeper about how progress is not in a straight line, and particularly spiritual progress.
Well, you come from such an interesting family. You were born, as you say, in 52. You were born in Florida.
I'm number 10 in a family of 12.
And number 10 in a family of 12. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as if your parents wanted to get the family out of the South.
You mean my dad wanting to be a black Yankee?
Your dad wanting to be a black Yankee. I guess you can't do that in the South, right? Or couldn't back then.
No. My brothers and sisters, because of the migrant stream, which was good money in the 40s, if you consider 8, 9, 10 cents a 100-pound bag of potatoes, good money. But these people who were field workers thought so, and he wanted to go north where his kids could have the same advantages, as he said, the white man's kids did. It's odd whenever I speak this way, I think I'm doing, am I playing the race card? I don't know how else to talk about the experience without the specificities of it, which is one thing Storytime is able to do. The stories range from something as personal as you and I are talking about, mm-hmm. to the political, to the esoteric, to the purely gossipy art world. But that's where my head is at, and that's what's wonderful about this indeterminate process.
And we're almost up on a break here, but I mean, it sounds as if your dad, he was determined, though. I mean, he was it a matter of just taking the family and taking that great migration north?
Well, he was migrating every year as it was, but he was not going to go back one year. And he was going to spend the winter, which was scary to people. These were southern people. People came north. They didn't have winter coats. So suddenly you're going to put down your roots there. And there was a statement I read in a manual once, something from the welfare department, that people who had been migrating, had stopped migrating less than 5 years, were at that time called stagnants. Isn't that an odd thing? Even as a child, maybe I read that in fourth grade. Oh, we're stagnants.
Well, on that note, we're going to take that very short break and then get back to our conversation. Bill T. Jones is our guest. As I said, one of the country's most celebrated dancers and choreographers. He has a new book called Story/Time, The Life of an Idea. It's a part memoir. It's also part discourse about being an artist and his wrestling match, if I can say, with John Cage. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Bill T. Jones about his life, about his ideas about dance and art, his wrestling, his struggling with composer John Cage. And his new book is called Story Time, The Life of an Idea. Again, part memoir, part discourse on the role of the artist and this debate about his creative relationship with composer John Cage. If you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So your parents were what, migrant farmers, I guess, or migrant workers?
Migrant workers. Yeah, they, in 1948, it was a growth industry in certain communities in the South. Just get a few trucks, an old bus, and the people. They want to go up north and make some money and get back down before the cold weather came. And in the beginning, it was good. People, mm-hmm. families came up. But as time went on, you found people with a lot of secrets, people who would say they're going to come up and work the season, but in fact, they just wanted to get to Buffalo, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. And so the money that my father would have laid out, that would be lost. And there were a lot of people who had drinking problems or what have you. But in the beginning, it was quite a romantic life, if you consider long, long days in the beating sun with weed killer and dust and desperation in the air.
Pesticides. Like that.
Yes. Right. So, but it was my father was an entrepreneur. Yeah. It was not so kind as mechanization came in. And by the early 60s, people were already using machines to harvest vegetables. And there was a cheaper labor force, as there always is. And those were Mexicans and other Hispanic workers moving into our area of the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, you lived in the Finger Lakes in New York, I guess northern New York. Were there other black families there?
They were sprinkled throughout this county. And I believe that in my high school, my grade school and high school, you could probably count on maybe two hands all of the black kids. Their families had been there, like my mother and father, maybe since the 40s. Very few might have been there earlier. I haven't figured out what that would have been. Would it have been Pullman porters on the railroad? What would they have been there for? But everybody would tell you they were just a generation from the South.
Your mother seems like a pretty strong, she's certainly a strong presence in this book.
Yes, she is. I mean, it's almost a cliche, isn't it? The black mother. But she was really that, a woman with deep religious feelings and deep wounds. You know, there's a story that I have in the book that I would like to read, that it was casually mentioned to me in a phone conversation by my sister Rodessa. And then it made its way into the story. I'll read for you.
That would be great.
My sister Rodessa tells me that on the morning after my father had died of a heart attack, members of the family were gathered at my mother's apartment. Estella, always emotional, was completely transported by her grief. Weeping, shouting, sometimes praying, she went through ever-mounting peaks of emotion. Her San Francisco Railroad apartment, a series of rooms connected by a long hallway, resounded with her agony. Estella, at 200 pounds, crashed about her living room, kicking and screaming like a child, pushing away anyone who tried to comfort her. At one moment, howling, she threw herself on the floor and proceeded to roll from one end of the hallway to the other, as a child would on a grassy hillside in the springtime.
It's a deeply moving passage.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was shocking to my sister when she heard, I did story time in Berkeley and she came with some friends. And I think, first of all, the intimacy of it. She said, well, Mama would never do that. I said, yes, but you told me this. Aww. And then she's never challenged me again. So I think she remembered. And also it was important because that last image, rolling like a child, and when you see the piece, how we as contemporary dancers use the floor, there are all sorts of echoes and counterpoints to the text. And that's what I think about movement and words, that they're always greater than the sum of their parts.
You also describe at her funeral hearing this someone crying, and it turns out it was you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was you crying.
Yes. Now, I think we're doing on a radio program exactly what a book promotion should do. But, you know, one thing that John Cage, who is always in the background, is saying, be careful of getting bogged down in the material.
Mm.
Move through it. Because he was trying to constantly get us to readjust our attitudes and readjust our expectations. So I'm with you. I love those particular stories. But he would say that they fall into a category of sentimentality. And
that's me.
Hey, that's most of us, actually.
That's right. Most
of us. And right. Hollywood makes a lot of money on it, right? So, but his system was that those stories of tragedy and oppression and all were coupled with kind of whimsical stories about picking mushrooms and Marshall McLuhan. And I think something he's getting at, those of us who have done meditation or even psychotherapy, that there is a constant den in the mind. And rather than to deny it, can we organize it in some way? And it doesn't have to have any climaxes. It moves like our life moves, and then it stops.
So do you sort of live in the world of John Cage with those more sort of abstract ideas about life and then also in the sentimental world?
Oh, I very much so. Very much so. Yes. I have, I was at Woodstock at 17. I listen sometime to music from that era. I don't listen with my companion nearby because he doesn't really like it so much. But I indulge, you know.
Right.
There's no harm in that. But then there's where does a mind get its biggest workout? You know, where does it get that kind of stretching and pulling that helps us go to another level of meaning in this life? And I do think that this life has a meaning. I don't know if it's an ultimate player, but there is something about art that helps us understand what that is.
Has that been dance then for you?
Dance has been one part of it. But I say art making is participation in the world of ideas. Reading, looking at other people's work, big fan of visual arts, all of those things. Even this conversation right now, I know this is a discourse that comes with our culture and it's a privilege, but it also is, you can feel the wheels grinding as we both understand and find ways to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what art is for me. But you know what? I also love a sweaty epiphany. You know, that's why I'm a dancer who comes from an athletic tradition. Mm-hmm. My dancers move beautifully. We give full-bodied value.
Oh, I like full-bodied. That's good, too.
Less blood on stage, but that happens as well. Anyways, when you come to see our shows, there's a lot of thinking up there. Mm-hmm. There's also something visceral that I hold to, and I think that has its place in the culture.
You mentioned meditation. I'd actually love to have you read another section. This I got a chuckle out of, and this, again, goes back to 1974. You're in college. It's on page 50, so you can everyone can read along with this. But Bill T. Jones, you can read this section as well.
It was the fall of 1974 in Binghamton. I moved in a fog of guilt and uncertainty, convinced that the only reliable life for me would be monastic. I was practicing yoga and chanting Hare Krishna daily. A guru had to be the solution, after all. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. Alone, down on my knees, performing my job at the university library, a voice said, "I have been looking for you." I looked up into the face of a handsome East Indian man beaming down at me. I was thunderstruck. Actually, he had been looking for a place to conduct his meditation classes, and someone must have told him I was a member of a dance collective with a loft in downtown Binghamton. I became one of his students, a vegetarian, and proposed celibacy to Arnie Zane. One Saturday morning at a street fair, I bumped into Mirsa, my teacher, eating a hot dog and strolling with his wife. I was shaken, though nothing was said then or later. He did teach me a number of mind-focusing exercises. We saw less and less of one another, and then he moved away.
That really happened?
That really happened. I always wonder if he's listening somewhere.
So this question of celibacy and being a vegetarian coming into question, right?
And I don't know if he ever said it. Was it me being presumptuous about it? But he certainly was married, and he was eating a hot dog that day. You know. But he taught, I think more than anything, it was something about the culture. And he wasn't making fun of the young Americans' need for an idealized, perfect India. But he was saying, you know, you have a lot to learn about these very ancient traditions. And I'm still learning.
And that's Bill T. Jones, our guest today on Radio Times. One of the most celebrated dancers, choreographers in the country. He's had an extraordinary career spanning more than 40 years. He's received a number of prestigious awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, a Kennedy Center Honor, two Tonys. And we're talking about his life. We're talking about dance. We're talking about ideas and his book, Storytime, The Life of an Idea. Again, part memoir and part discourse on the role of the artist. If you'd like to join our conversation, again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. So when you were, and I keep going back to, you know, the very analog way of talking about your life, but did you discover dance? I mean, was it just taking a class and then all of a sudden you thought, this is who I am?
Well, one of my set pieces in answering that question is to say that dance found me. I was an athlete at the university. My niece, Marion Young, who is my age, she said to me one day, "Don't go to those track practices. Don't go to track practice. Come with me to these African dance classes." "What? Just come." So my coach, nice guy, said, "Okay, as long as you're working on your cardiovascular, you'll be fine." Little did he know, he was giving me away. I went to that class and I opened the door, and there's a kind of a sweat from a dance studio, that smell that hits you in the face. And either you run away or you think, this is for me. And there were drummers of every shade, all male, on the side, and it was hot. And there was Percival Board, this gorgeous Trinidadian man with these amazing arms. And it was a place, it was kind of a melting pot. It was the high 70s, lots of young black women wrapped in galas and with hair either like Angela Davis or Cornrowed, full of pride. And, you know, we deserve to be in the front of the room because this is our culture, but we'll let you sons and daughters of Jewish lawyers and doctors, you could be in the back. And I was there to, quote, dig the scene, as we said. Uh-huh. And before I know it, more and more time was being spent in the dance studio. I met Arnie Zane, and he said, you really want to know something about art? Let's go to Amsterdam. He took me to Europe. I saw ballet at a very high level. I began to take dance classes. And before you know it, it was clear that it was going to be in the theater, but it wouldn't necessarily be saying other people's words, not initially. That would come back to me years later. So I went off in search of a pure physical expression, which was dance.
Would you say you're self-taught? Or that you've borrowed from things that you've seen?
I've taken classes, and I've been with some pretty sophisticated thinkers, and I've so I couldn't say entirely self-taught, but no, I didn't start doing dance when I was 6 years old. I started when I was 19. Mm-hmm. But I did study Cecchetti Ballet, and I did study Humphrey Wideman. No, I didn't study the classic techniques of Horton technique, which is Alvin Ailey. No, I did refuse to go to New York and let Mr. Ailey finish me, as people would say.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. If you're a young black man, you know, go to New York, and that's the only place you could go. And then later came Arthur Mitchell. But there was something about my background in that German-Italian community and the allure of the counterculture that said, nobody tells you what your path should be. And I met a wonderful man, Arnie Zane, and later we met Lois Welk, who is now an important member of your community, and dance community. She was more sophisticated than I. She had graduated from a dance program, and she not only took me deeper into the classical modern world, but also pointed the way to things like contact improvisation, mm-hmm. a very democratic form developed by the great Steve Paxton using Aikido. But we were scanning constantly. Arnie was a photographer. We were in the cinema department listening to those lectures about form and time and space. So what does it mean to be self-taught? You just have to be extremely curious and hungry.
And open, it sounds like.
Yes, open. And only when you get to the middle age you realize you thought you were totally open, but you had a lot of prejudices. Still finding that one out.
Yeah, aren't we all? And that's Bill T. Jones, our guest here on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I would assume, though, and even just looking at you now, I mean, you still look like a runner or a sprinter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That also helped in terms of developing yourself as a dancer.
You know, I really don't know the answer to that. Another glib answer used to be when people would say, admiring my body, I said, 300 years of selective breeding. You know,
it's another way to think about it,
yes.
Right?
Yes, not everybody in my family has a trim stomach, though. But there was something I do believe that dance gives back. At least the dance that I came into, which was about sweat, which was about stretching and shaping the body, extreme body consciousness, which, as you know, particularly for women, mm-hmm. can be a real problem. But it gave back in a certain way of understanding. There are these alarm bells that go off when you haven't been moving for a while. And, you know, you do sort of always pinching and looking at the weight. And there is an appreciation for being able to get up on your feet and move at any moment. I have a young relative who's now a former dancer, actually a show dancer, who is paralyzed from the waist down.
Oh, how did that happen? Health.
Oh. And, and drugs. He said to me when we were talking, one of his biggest distresses was, he said, Uncle Bill, I always felt that I could always run away. I said, what do you mean, physically run away or emotionally? He said, well, I guess both. So there's something about a dancer. You can use your body. You can seduce. You can draw people to you. You can scram. the dance life does tend to keep you a child for a long time. It makes one very self-centered, and yet there's something so fragile, because you can be walking down the street in peak health and you go over on the side of your ankle and you're out for 5 weeks, and it seems that your life stops. But it also keeps the heart pumping, and I think that if you listen to it, you can go into your middle age and still have a pretty trim physique.
I'm interested. I understand the kind of selfishness, perhaps, even just because you have to take care of yourself.
Self-involvement.
Mm-hmm. But to feel like a child, how does dance keep someone a child?
Well, let's put it this way. Let's start with classical dance. If you think about it, a high-level ballerina probably has been, since the age of 3 or 5, going every day into a situation where people are looking at her every move and telling her what to do. And what did George Balanchine say, supposedly, to Gelsey Kirkland? Don't think, dear. I think you do. You know, I don't. Did he really mean that? But you didn't. In his generation, you didn't need a thinking dancer. It might have been a problem. Merce Cunningham and others changed that. But I think also there's this feeling that youth, I've got to stay young and pliable, and I've got to be able to have those qualities I had when I was 18, 19, 20. And the body changes. By the time one is in their mid-30s, it's very difficult to compete with the physical energy of a 21-year-old, particularly for men, and maybe for women as well.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Bill T. Jones is our guest. We are talking about dance, and he has been a dancer for more than 40 years. He's also a choreographer and a director, and he's got a new book called Story/Time, The Life of an Idea. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Bill T. Jones, and we've been talking about his life as a dancer. He's also a choreographer and a director. And again, he's got this new book. It's called Story Time, The Life of an Idea. And again, if you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I'm sort of jumping around with your life and also some of your ideas as well. You had mentioned Arnie Zane, who was, I guess,
Arnie Zane was a co-founder of my company, Bill T. Jones, yes. Arnie Zane Dance Company. Arnie Zane was a Bronx-born Jewish-Italian man who I met at the university when he was coming back from a sojourn in Amsterdam, and I was in my freshman year. And he and I became partners in life and definitely partners in art. And as I say in my memoir from a few years back, Last Night on Earth, we thought that life was a great adventure you should run out to meet.
Yeah.
And we saw ourselves as Renaissance men. And he helped me found this company. And when he was growing sick and dying, he said, you know, Bill, you're not temperamentally suited to have a company. Go off and do your solo work. There'll always be some place for you. But when he died, I felt that I want to keep my company as a kind of living memorial to our relationship. And I would say it more vehemently and say that we were not eunuchs, that we actually had an offspring. Now, Arnie has been gone since March of 1988, and just this summer I married my companion, Bjorn Amelin, a man who is also an artist.
Did you think back in 1988 that you would ever get married to a man?
Marriage was not really on our mind. You know, this is the Joni Mitchell generation. We don't need a piece of paper from the city hall keeping us tried and true.
Yeah.
And I feel it now among some of my middle-aged friends, the idea of they look at me like, have you given up the faith? Have you fallen into the heteronormative bourgeois way of thinking?
Have you?
Oh, no, you know, please, if only I could be heteronormative, you know, or a bourgeois. No, I have too much wildness and there's something unkempt in my expectations of this life that no, I don't. I want to be responsible, though. I'm traveling with my friend's 94-year-old mother who, when she was in Antwerp in the beginning of the war, decided there were two kinds of people, those who need help and those who give help. And she proceeded to live an exemplary life working in a holding camp during the Vichy government, becoming a nurse working in Africa. This woman, when I'm with her, I want to stand up straight. And she calls me her third son, the one she didn't give birth to. I want to be able to earn that. And yet, I reserve that selfish, self-involved artist part as well that allows me to go into the studio for hours and think about nothing but what I'm thinking about.
You asked me during the break whether when I talk to artists, we talk about religion. I
mean, or was it a bit like talking about religion?
About religion. And I sort of hemmed and hawed and didn't exactly answer your question. I talked about the kind of deep thinking, I think, that artists engage in. They can't always talk about it, but they might experience it. But you talked about artists providing a kind of service.
Well, yes, I say that many artists, when you scratch down, they don't believe that what they do is the same thing as someone who might be a firefighter or a doctor. They believe that they're doing something that is more about philosophy. I say we're on the front line of understanding this dilemma of being a human being. And we're required to find form to do that. And ever since we understood how to make arrowheads out of stone or take burnt burnt wood and draw on the walls, human beings have distinguished themselves as being able to do that. It's a grand tradition. I say this sounds a bit pompous. It's not a vocation. It's an avocation.
Because I keep asking you, sort of saying what you do. What are you doing? What are you doing? You're saying, you know, I don't think about it as doing.
But you keep me honest. Because quite frankly, I've got to pay my rent as well.
Right.
I have young artists working under me who need their health insurance, who want to have children. I am just another human being that must wash my clothes as well. No, and I can be wrong. And I can be extremely arrogant. And I need to be slapped. But I love it when I get it right and people applaud and say, amen, brother.
Are you glad you were born when you were? You were born in 52.
Yes. Oh, yes. I think it was a great time to be born. Scary time. But as gay men, we understood we benefited from the so-called sexual revolution. It got us into trouble with AIDS and so on. But, you know, life is for learning. I think women, definitely the birth control and those bloody battles right now about reproductive rights. But the fact is, most women I know have some sense of control over their bodies, or at least they're willing to fight for it. So it was a good time. For black people, we're still trying to find our way out of that. But there is... I think we're better off, at least I am. My father and mother are potato pickers. I am not a potato picker. I do this other thing. So, no, I'm very pleased when I was born.
You're also HIV positive.
Yes, I am.
And I imagine when you got that diagnosis, thinking, my life on this earth is very limited, but here you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at this point in the conversation, I would say, how was your last pap smear?
Yeah.
You know, it's very...
Is that too personal a question?
It is. It is, but it's okay. It's okay. But I'm talking to a woman, a strong woman, but you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
1 in 4 women will die of breast cancer.
Right.
Right? So that's... We all know that about your condition. I'm HIV positive. Mm-hmm. What does that mean now? So I have the best care in the world. I'm in great health. And I fully intend to live to be 90, as Dora Amalon is.
Well, and I ask that not to put you on the spot, but it is a different disease today.
It is and it isn't, isn't it? I believe that there's still a lot of people who struggle with misinformation. You'd be surprised at how many young men, old enough to be my children, when I've been working with them, I'll see them morose and they'll say, can I have a conversation with you? I can almost tell now what it is, and I am so saddened. I said, weren't you paying attention to us? Well, you know, he loved me. He said he loved me. What do you mean he said he loved you? It is and it is not.
I'd love to have you read another section from your book here, section you picked out.
Yes. Max Roach told of the day when Abby Lincoln and he were excitedly putting the finishing touches on a Thelonious Monk tune, to which Abby had written lyrics. They were excited because Monk himself was to come by. He came, listened intently to their performance, whispered something into Abby's ear, and then left. Max asked her what Monk had said, and here Max, doing a perfect imitation of Monk's curiously gruff, gravelly speech, whispered, "Next time, make a mistake."
Why did you want to read that? That's a great passage.
Well, because it's, how often do you hear of someone say, make a mistake? And I think that's the whole thing about being an artist, and particularly, I think, can I say this? A badass, like a Thelonious Monk. You know, I play with, he was making a statement about indeterminacy.
Right.
He was saying that sometimes that is out of your control is exactly what you should be paying attention to. I like that. And it's so hip. He was a madman as well, but he left such a trail of beauty, and he inspires to this day. Make a mistake. Now, we don't want our doctors to make mistakes.
I was just going to say,
we don't want our politicians to make mistakes. But there's a class called artists that have to deal in chance, because that's the way the universe works.
Do you incorporate that in when you're doing and you're working on something now? But when you're doing a choreography or writing a choreography, do you think? I mean, I'm curious about how you work. Perhaps I can put it that way.
Well, it comes from two different directions. For your ballet lovers out there listening, if they love Serenade, one of George Balanchine's early masterpieces, there's a point where a group of women run across the stage and one young woman beautifully throws herself down to the ground. Well, as I understand it, when they were working on this piece and he didn't have the best dancers, somebody tripped and fell. And he said, oh, keep it, dear. And now it's one of those most poignant moments in the ballet. That was a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, somebody stumbled. We always must stay open to the unexpected and the indeterminate influencing what we think we understand and what we should do. It's a balance. Can you be a good parent, a good partner, and at the same time be open to the fact that I am imperfect and that maybe my imperfection will be a good thing for my children to see, for my companion to observe? And what about your audience? The same thing. Vulnerability is part of what we're talking about. But you got to have a good eye, and you have to be fearless as an editor. I don't know how good my eye is, and I'm certainly not fearless as an editor.
Oh, fearless with yourself, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You fall in love with things.
Right.
And who is going to tell you, you know, maybe that's too much there, or maybe you need to go deeper here. That's what keeps it exciting.
Right. I mean, do you have someone who does that for you?
I have several of them. One is my associate artistic director, the first one since Arnie Zane Dance, and her name is Janet Wong, fantastic woman, who I met when she was at the Berlin Opera Ballet. She has dance Balanchine, and yet she loves contemporary dance. And my companion, now my husband, Bjorn Amelon, who is so Talmudic in his take on things. It's infuriating how sometimes I'll ask him an opinion, and he'll say, well, it's this, but it could be that, you know. And then he looks me in the eye, and he is just to say, you know what to do. You know what to do. And I have to look deeper and make a choice.
So what do you look for in dancers? It looks like you look for a lot of things, but is there a certain kind of dancer that you feel understands you?
Well, I would say something glib, like I'm looking for the dancer I didn't know I was looking for. There was a dancer, Arthur Avila, is one of the greatest of his generation, who came to an audition that was so crowded. I never do this. The audition was so crowded, even before they did anything, I was walking around the room and telling people, please, thank you for coming, please leave, because I knew that I wasn't going to use them. But then he stood up, a man I was not looking for, and there was something about the way in which he was doing the movement. He wasn't executing the steps the best, but the commitment. And he showed me potential in the steps and in the exercises that I thought that I didn't know was there. So that dancer has got to be mesmerizing. There's a floor full of people. This dancer who is, even as I say, not necessarily the best, but I can't stop looking at him or her. You don't know until a few weeks, months, sometimes a year, if that person is right for the chemistry of the group. But there's an intuition that kicks in when you first see them attack space or make an offering of an improvisational sequence.
Do you still dance at all?
I dance when I'm very happy.
Do you?
And that's when my companion is making dinner, when I'm at a party. And I have another major solo inside of me. I hope I can find the time to do it. and that these knees and lower back and ankles hold out.
Is that where you feel it?
Oh,
your
yes.
Years of dancing?
Right knee, because I used to be a great jumper, but unfortunately I was always using the same leg to jump and land on. So I did some damage to it, which I no replacement, but I also grew impatient, and a year of physical therapy turned into about six months, and I should have gone longer.
Oh.
And I have creaks and groans in places that I never had them before. But an old man dancing is a beautiful thing because he has to do much more with less.
And that's Bill T. Jones, our guest today on Radio Times. Do you think of yourself as an old man? You're in your early 60s.
Oh, I'm being a little dramatic there.
Right.
I don't know what an old man is, you know. I'm proud that I got here. Arnie Zane died when I was 39.
Yeah. So
I thought that I would be lucky if I lived to see 40 or 40, 45. I never thought that I'd have another companion. Now I have a wonderful companion. So, no, I don't think of myself as an old man, but I wear my years with pride. I do. I really am. I have a lot to be grateful for.
You got a Tony for Fela, and also for Spring Awakening.
Spring Awakening, yes.
Spring Awakening as well. I'm interested in sort of how Fela came to be. Is there a short version of that?
Praise to Steve Hindell, a man who was an oil trader and who said that that's my day job and I love this music. He had discovered the music probably now 12, 13 years ago. He said it was the greatest music that nobody had ever heard of. What he meant to say was that the commercial world had never heard of. He and his wife are investors in many shows. So it became his passion and it remains. He approached my lawyer, who happens to be his lawyer. My lawyer said, "Do you know this Fela guy?" I said, "Well, yeah, he was big news in the 70s. We all knew him. Well, I have a man who wants to make a show about him, and he wants you to do it." And so he paid me the greatest compliment, which was to come and see one of my crazy dance concerts with a death metal band or whatever you want to call it. And after it was over, he said, "You know what? You're the guy to do this show."
Oh, wow.
I said, "Well, hallelujah." And we started. Took 2 years to just get the rights even, to clear it with the family. And now the work has a life. A documentary has been made. It's had two tours. And someday we may bring it back. But Steve was an angel, and it was Steve's great faith in Fela and faith in me that allowed it to be made.
And so serendipitous that you had these important people in common.
Yes, it's true, but isn't life like that, though,
yes,
right?
That's
the indeterminate underpinnings of existence. Not to sound too pretentious, but that's the way I feel about these things.
That was dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones, who was a guest on Radio Times last fall. His career has spanned more than 40 years, and his work has never shied away from controversial issues. His book, Story Time, Life of an Idea, was inspired by a John Cage piece called Indeterminacy. Jones's book is a mix of autobiography and his thoughts on the role of the artist and the audience. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can download a podcast of the show. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook and on satellite radio. And sign up for the weekly Radio Times newsletter. And coming up next, it's Radio Times in Review, 3 perspectives on childhood. Stay with us.